Fork Tales, a podcast that feeds ideas to the food and beverage world. Fork Tales is brought to you by Vigor, a branding and advertising agency focused on the restaurant and hospitality industry, and by Quench, a food and beverage advertising agency that specializes in evolving iconic food and beverage brands. Learn more, visit vigorbranding.com and quenchagency.com. If you love what we're serving up, please give Fork Tales a 5-star review on your podcast service of choice. Think of it as a tip for good service.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Fork Tales. Today's guest, a good friend of mine, Tom Moffitt, a pioneer in the plant-based dairy world. Tom co-founded Commonwealth Dairy, built it into a national powerhouse, and now is back at it with Culture Fresh Foods, creating the next generation of non-dairy favorites. Tom, welcome to Fork Tales, and thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Michael. I appreciate you having me on.
So, I was reading up some of the stuff about you and your Culture Fresh Food story. So talk about Culture Fresh Foods and what is it, you know, what inspired you to create it? How did this all happen?
Yeah. So as you mentioned a little bit earlier, so I used to be in the dairy industry. I owned a company called Commonwealth Dairy in Brattleboro, Vermont. And we were a very large private label Greek yogurt producer. So I followed what Chobani and Faye were doing in the mm-hmm. branded space and followed them in with private label Greek yogurt. And we were supplying most of the major retailers in the U.S. So I started that in 2010. And it was in 2017, I had partners, financial and strategic partners on the project. They wanted to shift the company more towards a branded focus. I was very, very set on private labels being the opportunity. Decided to leave the company. And I love manufacturing, but wasn't really sure what to do. And I figured the easiest way to figure that out was just to go. I had all these great customers. I was supplying people like Wegmans and Costco and Aldi. And I just went to those customers and asked them what they wanted. You know, I figured, why swim upstream? You might as well just swim downstream and give people what they want. And
imagine that, asking a customer what they want, right?
So this was, you know, in 2017, you know, brands like Oatly, Impossible Burger, mm-hmm. Beyond Meat, like all those things, Silk, you know, all mm-hmm. those things were really exploding. So plant-based was really starting to hit its stride back then, really starting to get a lot of attention. At that time, my kids were younger. My older son, would have been somewhere around 12, 13 years old. He was, lactose intolerant, ate a lot of plant-based products. And I kind of realized, you know, younger consumers in particular are really interested in plant-based. And I thought, hey, this could be the next sort of like what happened with Greek yogurt, where Greek yogurt didn't exist, you know, 20 years ago as a thing mm-hmm. and became, you know, part of a $10 billion yogurt category. Greek yogurt's probably around $4.5 billion of it. I thought, hey, plant-based could do the same thing. And, you know, I had these customers asking for it. So that was sort of the aha moment and started working on it in 2017 and ultimately bought a plant. I bought a yogurt plant in Connecticut in 2019. It was a dairy yogurt plant and I transitioned it and transformed it over to a plant-based plant focused mm-hmm. on making a wide spectrum of plant-based products, yogurt, sour cream cheese. Mm-hmm. And that was really, you know, that got us going. And unfortunately for me, I opened my doors in the March of 2020, about 2 weeks before COVID. Mm-hmm. That really sucked, to be honest, because we weren't really in market yet. And we were having all these conversations with retailers who wanted private label plant-based products, but put everything on, you know, they put all their products on hold because, you know, COVID really sort of just, as you guys know, was just a complete shift in
and then
the market.
I'm sure you had a bunch of capital expenditures that you're just sitting on because you couldn't make stuff and the, you know, the market was not there and all that good stuff. So
yeah, it was tough. I mean, we barely kept our lights on for the first year and a half. We were doing a little bit of co-packing for some large brands, but we were really running the plant 3 days a week, one shift 3 days a week for about the first year and a half, 2 years. And that was really tough just to keep on going.
So I want to back up a second because I mean, you know, I feel like, and I'm addicted to entrepreneurs, and you are an entrepreneur. I am one. I love it. The energy, the ideas. So, but how does one? Because it sounds obvious, like, oh, you know, of course, make plant based yogurt and do co-packing and private label, and that's great. Oh, what a great niche. What a great business. And you know, it makes all the sense in the world. But how does one wake up one day and start into the Greek yogurt off-brand or private label market?
Like, how do you just bad word. Off-brand is a bad word, Michael.
I know, slide back. private label, not brand, but private label. But how do you do that? Like, how do you wake up and say, I'm going to start a factory doing making this?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a life story. Like, I got into the food business. I got very interested in food. I'm a food microbiologist by training.
Right.
And people used to joke with me that I went to a graduate school in Wisconsin. And I had the Wisconsin resume. I worked in cheese and beer. and so I had the dairy side covered. I had the beer side covered. And my first company was a distributing company. I had a small distributing company in Madison, Wisconsin, and was distributing beers, wine, sodas, juices. It was like, you know, kind of like the alternative niche distributor. Mm-hmm. Very tough business, learned a lot. I'm from the East Coast. So I sold out my share of that partnership to my business partner, moved back to the East Coast, and took a job with Ahold, which is a large grocery retailer.
Sure.
Back at that time, owned a whole bunch of retail banners like Giant and Stop and mm-hmm. Shop and Buy Low Bruno's, owned U.S. Foods. And they needed somebody who knew something about dairy. And I knew dairy. I knew how dairy markets worked. I'd done some internships in a cheese company. I used to also distribute milk at my distributing company in Wisconsin. So I understood enough about dairy to be dangerous. And they put me into the role of sourcing, being in charge of their dairy and frozen private label products. So sourcing those products.
There you go.
Yeah. And so that was, and I took that job knowing that I wanted to start another business. I just didn't know what to do. So I had left the business in Wisconsin, moved back to the East Coast, had no idea what I wanted to do. The only thing I knew is I wanted to start a business.
Yeah.
And when I got the job with Ahold, I figured what better way to figure out what to do than to be buying stuff and seeing what's hard to buy.
Right.
And back then, that was 2005. There were two things that were really hard to buy. Believe it or not, it was frozen waffles. Yep, frozen waffles and yogurt. Those were the two hard things to buy. Because frozen waffles, a large Pillsbury plant had burned down.
Okay.
And so most frozen waffles were coming from Canada. And there was a shortage of them. And yogurt, there just were not many people doing private label yogurt back then.
Yeah.
And the light bulb aha moment for me was, well, private label yogurt was growing at, yogurt consumption was growing at 10% per year. Waffles were growing at like 1%. I'm a food microbiologist. I get really excited about yogurt. For me, that was the intersection of business and, science, really.
Yeah.
It's a cultured product.
And your passion, right?
Yeah, and my passion. And so I wrote a business plan. And, it's one of those kind of classic, I guess, entrepreneurial stories. I wrote a business plan and everybody thought I was crazy, like including mm-hmm. my wife. My mm-hmm. wife told me I was literally nuts. and it took me 2.5 years to raise the money. And I finally was able to raise the money from a German family-owned company who had the same vision I did. They saw an opportunity in yogurt production in the U.S., that the market was just underdeveloped, that there was opportunities for innovation. And so we partnered and built a small plant in Brattleboro, Vermont, and struck the timing just right. I mean, we opened our doors literally right when Chobani was starting to take off. And I look back at my notes. We started our first plant expansion 2 days after we opened our doors. 2 days after we opened the doors, the plant was completely full. And we started the first plant expansion.
That's amazing.
And yeah, we expanded that plant 3 times and then built a huge plant out in Arizona.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So it was a fun ride.
Yeah. How did that experience then with Commonwealth Dairy, how did that influence your way into the culture of fresh foods?
So, there's a number of things I took away from it. One of the big takeaways for me was just like, financially, I had a financial partner in that business. They were a very large player in Europe. And one of the things that I realized is in my first year in business with them, I never went to their home country and had to meet with them. By my last year in business with them, I was in their home country like every 6 weeks talking mm-hmm. to a board and trying to convince them of what what I thought we should do. And that became pretty taxing. And so when I started my Culture Fresh Foods, one of my sort of personal conditions is I didn't want to go to a big company and get the funding. I wanted to be able to, I kind of wanted to fund it on my own and fund it with, other individual investors who were people I knew directly, or maybe one or two, sort of degrees of separation. But I didn't want one large financial partner who could kind of ultimately control what we did. So that was sort of one thing that I took away and brought into Culture Fresh Foods. The other thing, just from a manufacturing standpoint, is my European partners, and I'm a food microbiologist, but they produced a very, very exacting standards. They had a lot of technology. They had been making yogurt for almost 100 years. They really knew what they were doing. And from a technical know-how standpoint, that's one of the things that I really just soaked up from them, was their mentality on how you do things right. You spare no expense when it comes mm-hmm. to quality, efficiency, and mm-hmm. just getting it right. And when I bought the yogurt plant in 2017, I spent a year and a half and invested a lot of money, mostly on improving quality standards, you know, just improving, you know, how we manage sanitation, manage quality control, manage micro risks. Because for me, it's all about food safety, food quality. And quality really means if you have a cup of my yogurt today, it's the exact same cup of yogurt you have, you know, 3 months from now. You don't get sort of just, you know, different experience because the product quality varies. And so I really try to infuse those principles into this business. And, you know, my view was over the long term, you're going to win. People are going to recognize the quality, recognize the consistency, and they're going to prefer your product over something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, I mean, you led that company and, you know, what made you decide this is time to jump out of the dairy side and go into the plant-based? Was it the trends? Was it just you were tired of the trips to Europe?
Yeah, it's a little bit of everything. I mean, so my business partners, they had a very strong branded and private label business in Europe. They're about 50% private label, 50% branded. Our business in the US was 90%, maybe 85% private label and 15% mm-hmm. branded. And they wanted to reorient the company much more strongly in the direction of brand. And I strategically didn't agree with that. You know, I had spent 7 years building these relationships with retailers saying, we're your strategic partner on your brand. Mm-hmm. It was going to be hard to go back to those customers and say, never mind everything I've been telling you for the past 7 years. I now want to sell you this new brand, this European brand. And that's what we're going to do. And so that was one piece of the puzzle, was just, you know, strategically difference of opinion on where we should lead the company. And also, you know, I saw the opportunity for plant-based when I was at my last company, and I had presented that to the board and said, hey, why don't we start a division and do this? And they weren't interested. You know, they had started off, their founding family was dairy farmers, and then they, you know, evolved into, you know, yogurt producers, and they just did not have an interest in going into the plant-based world.
Mm-hmm. Tell the story. I mean, I read somewhere that you were like sitting with a guy, I guess it was a bunch of dairy folks, at breakfast. And can you get into that a little bit? Tell the story. Well, I love that.
I was still in the dairy business. This was probably back in 2014-ish. So really early on for plant-based in the US.
You're like 12.
Yeah. So not quite, I wish. But I went to a National Dairy Association meeting, and you know, one of the neat things they do at that meeting is that they randomly assign you to a breakfast table. So you're going to be at a table of, you know, 20 other guys or gals that you don't know. And, you know, it's neat because it's networking. And, you know, I remember sitting down at this table, and there's a mix of dairy farmers and dairy processors there. And, you know, the conversation when I arrived at the breakfast table was, you know, damn these oat milks and almond milks and soy milks. We're going to sue those guys. You know, this is a bunch of dairy farmers. We're going to sue them into submission. You know, they can't use the word milk. And I have no view on whether or not the word milk is appropriate for plant-based products. There's obviously two sides to that coin. But, you know, they were having just a passionate argument how they're going to sue these companies out of existence. And I kind of raised my hand and said, hey, look, you know, we're dairy processors, we're dairy farmers, like we're perfectly positioned to, you know, take advantage of this. Like we should be the ones who are like on the forefront of that. Like if somebody else, if people want plant-based milk, we could do dairy milk, we can do oat milk. Like it shouldn't matter. We should be agnostic and just want to take advantage of the opportunity because give the market what they want. Like you can't sue the market. Right. And I'm thinking about my son, right? My son's not going to drink dairy milk. And I'm trying to explain to the table, like, we're not going to sue the market at what the market wants. The market is the market. And I literally was, I'm not exaggerating, I was asked to leave the table. And I was like, all right, you know, so I took my bagel and my coffee and found another table.
I mean, you know, so some of those good old boys,
there's some strong opinions.
Yeah, there's some strong opinions there. You got to respect that lifestyle and what they bring to food and everything else. It's awesome. But I could see how that would be a little bit of a conflict. And that's what's kind of amazing to me. Again, you know, whenever people are successful, everyone thinks it's like supernatural. Like, well, of course that happened, or oh, you know, everybody eats that, so of course that's the right thing to make. But I mean, you made decisions throughout your career. I mean, I when we talk branded, okay, and when we talk even back on the dairy side, like I'm a Quench, okay, that's what I do. I make brands. That's my job. I love branding. I mean, that's what I do, and I'm very passionate about it. But I also understand, it's kind of funny. I've interviewed literally, I think there's 100 episodes now of this, people who when someone on the CPG side, someone on the restaurant side, but on the CPG side, it's like if you're a manufacturer, you want a brand because you feel like the grass is greener, okay? If you have a brand, you want the manufacturing facility. You want to get away from your co-packer. And it's always that interesting conundrum. And, you know, it feels like no one's ever satisfied being on one side of that that coin. And I get the balance, but you know, to the point
sexy.
What's that?
The brands are sexy.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, that's what we do. We create sex. That's our job.
Yeah. And I get it. I mean, that's the tension. I mean, at my old company, you know, at my dairy company, we were, like I said, 85% private label. But 15% of it was branded. We had a brand called Green Mountain Creamery. Mm-hmm. It was highly successful in the Northeast.
Yep.
And that's what we were trying to do. We were trying to sort of capture a little bit of both. I mean, we were definitely operators. We were manufacturers first and foremost, mm-hmm. but we hit it just right with this idea of this sort of local premium, you know, Vermont made yogurt. And it was very, very popular and successful. And, you know, we were fortunate because we were also the manufacturer. And I felt for those brands that had to use co-packers. We had brands come to us all the time that mm-hmm. wanted us to co-pack for them. You know, we couldn't because we had such a constraint on our capacity because we were just growing so fast in both the branded and private label business. But it's tough. I mean, I've seen and I've known personally lots of, and you kind of allude to this, like lots of brand owners go out of business.
Yeah.
Not because of them, but because of their co-packer. Their co-packer right. fails them in some way. The co-packer, yeah. you know, can't keep up with their volume, changes the pricing, whatever it might be. There's a million sure. stories, but you know, it's sometimes difficult to kind of have your baby, you know, the life of your baby completely reliant on somebody else.
That's
and
right.
we'll experience it on my side now because I'm a co-packer for a bunch of these, you know, we co-pack for a number of large brands. But we take it very seriously. I mean, I that's just my ethos. Like, I don't want to fail them. You know, they're my customers. I don't want to fail them. And, you know, I believe in very direct and open and courageous communication. If we have a challenge, we let them know what it is. And we hope they understand it. And we want to work through those challenges with them.
Well, you know, it's funny when you said how you really kind of got your, the education, if you will, or you were able to really learn things being at Ahold. Ahold's in our market. I started my company right outside of Carlisle, you know, and they are, we've worked with them. They are really a tremendous company. And I'll say the people that have come out of Ahold, really smart individuals, hardworking. And, you know, I could see how that could be a really, really phenomenal place to learn and see things and grow. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a great place to be. You know, I was there during a tough time because Ahold as an entity was having challenges across the retail banners. You know, when I was there, when I started with Ahold, they owned 6 retail banners. Mm-hmm. They ended up selling Bilo and Bruno's and Tops, and they sold US Foods off, which obviously is food service. But the people who were there really cared. I mean, they obviously, mm-hmm. People worked really hard. They really wanted to be successful. I was fortunate. You know, I had a great boss there, a gentleman named Michael Sherman, who taught me a lot about commodity sourcing, understanding kind of how to think through commodities and, you know, pricing and costing and things like that. And that helped me a great deal and still helps me today because, you know, that's another piece of the puzzle is you got to make sure you've got the right cost structure and margin structure. And that can get pretty tricky in dairy and particularly tricky in plant-based where the products are just, you know, tend to be more complex in terms of the ingredient makeup. But good organization. Lots of people worked there. Very, very passionate people who really cared about, you know, food and retail and grocery.
So, you know, you mentioned the, obviously the plant based, and that's your manufacturing, and that's your niche. What are some of the biggest obstacles preventing people from fully embracing plant based dairy? Is it taste, price, accessibility? I mean, like when we see the consumer, I mean, what are you hearing out there?
Well, I think you hit a couple of them. I think certainly there's a price. You know, there's a price premium to plant-based. And, you know, I often get asked, well, why is plant-based yogurt so much more expensive than dairy-based yogurt? And it's very simple. It just comes down to ingredient cost. I mean, you know, if you're making a coconut or almond yogurt, you know, you're a factor of some multiple of 10x over the cost of milk. I mean, the U.S. is an incredibly efficient milk producer. Mm-hmm. I would say probably, you know, there's very few countries that can compete with the U.S. in terms of efficiency of milk production. So you've got a very largely available, you know, low cost commodity in milk. And when you're trying to, you know, you're importing ingredients, some of these ingredients are imported, or you're using nuts like almonds, you know, this is a more expensive ingredient. It's also mm-hmm. more complicated to process it. Because for us, quite frankly, I mean, we make the milk. So when I have a co-pack client, the first question is, well, what kind of milk do you want? You know, do you want almond milk, cashew milk, macadamia milk, coconut milk? So you've got to make the milk. And then we take the milk and we have to culture it or convert it into the finished product. And mostly what we do is yogurt. So we're culturing it into yogurt. You know, and I'll sometimes joke with the my customers, I'll say, you know, I missed the good old days when it was dairy. You had three choices for me. It was like, you want non-fat, low-fat, or whole milk.
Right.
You know, it's just, it's going to be dairy milk.
Right.
But it's either non-fat, low-fat, or whole milk. It's just more complex. So pricing cost is one issue that keeps consumers, I think, is kind of slowing adoption because it's more expensive.
Sure.
You can buy a cup of, you know, dairy Greek yogurt for $1 and a cup of, you know, coconut yogurt for $2. So that's a big difference. The other thing is, you know, to some degree, it's taste. Now, I think the amount of money that's been invested in plant-based over the last just 10 years is astronomical. And there's been massive strides made on the taste and texture of products. So your non-dairy milks, your non-dairy yogurts, they've gotten much better. We have people we make a coconut yogurt where people eat it and they're like, I cannot believe this isn't dairy. It's a, you know, coconut cream. It's a very creamy, rich yogurt. Mm-hmm. It does extremely well for us. And that's the number one comment we get. I can't believe this isn't dairy yogurt. And then the other one is nutritional profile. That's the other big one I see, is that plant-based has by and large lagged behind dairy in terms of just protein content, sugar content, just in terms of matching up in regards to nutritional profile. Plant-based is more challenging because plants just don't have as much protein or other nutrients as dairy does. And so the solve for that is people, you know, you have to fortify with pea protein or, you know, whatever, you know, all, you know, almond nut protein concentrate, you know, and so you're trying to boost protein contents. And quite frankly, as a dairy, you know, as a dairy guy who became a plant-based guy, plant-based proteins generally taste like dirt. I mean, that's just, you know, people have been raised on dairy. And dairy proteins taste pretty darn good. By and large, people like the taste of them. And plant-based proteins are just much more challenging to work with. Now, again, that being said, there's a lot of money and technology being invested in this, and they are getting better. There's huge strides being made on that front. So the gaps are narrowing. You know, plant-based yogurt prices have been generally coming closer to dairy-based yogurt pricing. Nutritional profiles are getting better. You know, the texture and taste and all those things are just, it's on a continuous improvement and it continue to get better.
Yeah. You know, you hit a couple of things that I think is interesting. Like, I mean, at Quench for the last 15, 16 years now, we've been doing food and beverage trends and we're constantly monitoring, following trends and watching because it enhances our clients, products and allows us to do take them into the future in a smart, you know, way with investment of their marketing and everything. You nailed two things. Obviously, the plant based thing you got on early and we're there, but also you're talking about protein. Protein has just been huge. It just keeps getting more and more important. I mean, it was a trend held 10 years ago, and now it just seems like it continues to grow and. Even with the you know, the GLP ones and all that stuff happening, the protein thing becomes bigger and bigger. And so, you know, I can see how that is not an issue, but I think that's something that you got to, you know, be aware of with the product, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Protein is one of the, I mean, you know, and I saw this back with my yogurt company. I remember talking to people back in like 2011, 12, like protein is it, like everything is going to be all about protein. And it has become that, you know. I walked down an aisle of a Costco store and Costco literally has an, if you walk a Costco and look for the word protein, they literally have entire aisles where every single product in that aisle is screaming at you protein and how much protein is in there. Protein is massive and low sugar. Those are the two big things.
You're right. You know,
people want more protein, less sugar, but at the same time, it's got to taste great. And that's, again, that's a tough combination right now for plant-based, although plant-based is getting better. Plant-based, again, I've only been in plant-based since 2017, and phenomenal strides have been made, and they will continue to make phenomenal strides, and we continue to make phenomenal strides because there's a lot of money being invested in plant-based proteins and basically finding better proteins, making them taste better. That is a big deal.
Sure. So where do you see the category headed in the next 5 years?
It's a great question. I mean, what I, you know, and one of the things I always do when I think about the future of food, I always try to think about, you know, as much as I hate to admit it, I'm getting old and I'm not the future consumer, you know, necessarily, right? Like I look at people like my son, you know, I always remember, I'll tell you a quick story. I went into a coffee shop to meet an investor in Seattle and it was probably about 9 a.m. And this place was bustling. I mean, packed. And, you know, looked around the room real quickly. And I was the oldest guy in that room by 20 years, at least 20 years. And I went to the barista, you know, he's all tattooed up with earrings, and I get a coffee and I like a coffee with a little bit of half and half, whatever. So I get a coffee, a little bit of room in there. I go over to the half and half station, and there's literally nine of those stainless steel canisters. And I pick up the first one, hemp, oat, cashew, almond. I go through all nine. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No half and half, no dairy half and half. And I like oat creamer or dairy half and half. Kind of depends on the morning and my
right,
mood.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that morning I felt like dairy half and half. So I go up to the barista, I said, hey, you guys happen to have any dairy half and half? And he looks at me and he looks over and he goes, huh, you're the first one to ask for that today. And he hands me the canister from the fridge. And that's where I think this is going. Like people like my son, he's in college now, doesn't even think, like, you know, I went and picked him up and we went to the dining hall and he's getting vegan pizza. And the vegan pizza is mixed in right with the regular pizza. Right. And, you know, as far as I can see, most of the kids are choosing the vegan pizza, which is just, you know, dough and sauce with non-dairy cheese. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to become completely interchangeable. Like me, like I said, you know, a second ago, like for me, it's just depends on the morning. Some mornings I have an oat creamer. Some mornings I have half and half. Just depends what I feel like. They have a different taste. And I just, you know, I use them interchangeably. And I think that's in 5 years, I think it's going to just be much more interchangeable. Like you're not getting, I don't think people will necessarily be thinking about, hey, I want a dairy yogurt or plant-based yogurt. I think I'd be thinking about, well, what brand do I feel like? What do I like? What do I feel like today? Do I want a coconut yogurt? Because I feel like a creamy, you know, coconut yogurt and, you know, coconut's got, you know, certain nutritional benefits to it that I want. Or, hey, you know, I've been eating coconut yogurt all weekend. I'm going to have a dairy yogurt. I think it's going to become more like that because really it's a small proportion of the population that's, you know, has to be for like a medical reason or, you know, a dietary reason on a plant-based product. Right. I think it's just going to become more interchangeable where more options, more flexibility.
Yeah. So you're kind of hitting another interesting thing. Do you think it'll ever replace dairy? Or do you think it'll sit alongside it? Or, I mean, even the word, the term plant-based, are we going to have to keep saying that? Like, I mean, is that, or does it just become like, you know, again, we make brands. So if I make a brand and it just happens to be quote unquote plant-based, but people like that, the flavor and the taste of that product, they'll just buy it, right? They're not going to sit there and say, again, unless you have dietary restrictions where you must, you know, you can't, you're lactose intolerant or whatever else. So how do you feel about that? Like, do you think it's going to replace dairy? Do you think they're going to sit next to each other? Is plant-based going to go away, that term?
I do not think it'll replace dairy in my lifetime. I think dairy is, I mean, when I look at the yogurt market, the yogurt market, it's about a 10 billion-ish market in the US, and somewhere around maybe 500-600 million of that maybe is plant-based yogurt. So plant-based yogurt is a very small piece of a very big market.
Yeah.
What I think will happen though is just you're going to get more interchangeability. Like you're going to have brands where, you know, you've got the dairy version and you're going to have one, and plant-based is a phrase right now is kind of going away a little bit. It'll be non-dairy. Because there are people looking for non-dairy for dietary reasons. But you might be like, wow, I really love the non-dairy coconut Jubilee yogurt by this brand. And, you know, but, you know, if you're going to go in the store and buy five, you know, cups of yogurt, you might be buying four that are dairy and one that's non-dairy. And the non-dairy one, maybe that's not even your first purchase, you know, premise. It's like, I'm buying it because that was a flavor I really like, or I think that one's super thick and creamy. Not because it's non-dairy, it's because I like that one.
Yeah. And it kind of goes back to branding too. Again, it's like anything, right? I mean, we all have favorite pizza and there are a lot of pizzas, the same ingredients, but some are better than others. And it comes down to branding, whether it's a restaurant or whether it's a frozen product in a grocery store, we're drawn to these brands and a brand's a promise. So if the promise is that this is going to be rich, creamy, and delicious, whether the fact that it's dairy or not probably really won't matter. Again, aside from any dietary restrictions, that's interesting. So, I mean, to plant-based dairy for the first time, if you're introducing someone to, let's say you want to give them a product that'll really wow them, you know, really good. What product would you start them with?
Well, it depends. I mean, you know, I'll talk about yogurt just because that's the majority of what we make. But, you know, you generally, you know, from my personal experience, we make a lot of yogurt. Coconut yogurt sell the best. Why? Because they taste the best. Yeah. So if you want to wow somebody, you know, a very rich and creamy, you know, high fat yogurt, coconut yogurt is going to probably wow them. And we have a lot of, you know, just as an example, we supply bulk coconut yogurt and we have retailers who are taking that and making it into, like those like yogurt parfaits that they sell in like the deli or the kind of cake and dough section. Those are doing phenomenally well. And I think it's simple. And they still have their low-fat vanilla parfait yogurts there. But I think the consumer's just like, geez, you know, I can get this probiotic coconut creamy yogurt. The coconut yogurt parfait tastes like dessert. And the low-fat yogurt tastes like breakfast. And I think so. Right. That's like just like instinctually, you're like, that tastes great. It's probiotic. I like it more. I'm going to buy it.
Yep.
So yogurt's a good place to start. The other one where we've had a lot of success, and again, it's just it's gotten very much closer, is ice cream. We make a lot of we make a coconut and oat-based non-dairy ice cream mix. We sell it to manufacturers who then put their own special touches on it, and they turn it into ice cream. And coconut-based non-dairy ice cream, if done well, will taste as good or better than a lot of the dairy ice creams.
Wow.
I mean, it's just because it's you know, again, because coconut's a very creamy, it's a very creamy, indulgent, rich, you know, ingredient. And so that's where we also see a lot of success for us. You know, people who are more into the, you know, into sort of the plant-based adoption curve, you know, almond yogurt would be probably the next step because it's got a nutritional profile, it's higher in protein, it's a little bit closer to dairy. But it tastes more like a traditional, like I would call like almond yogurt tastes like a traditional blended yogurt. Coconut yogurt tastes like dessert.
Yeah. Yeah. Is one in theory better for you or healthier for you than the other?
You know, people have their own different, you know, visions of what, you know, and it depends on what you're looking for. Like we have people who really want coconut yogurt because they feel like those are healthy fats and there's certain, like that's a nutritional profile they want. And then almond yogurt has more protein. So, you know, it kind of cuts both ways depending on what the individual consumer is looking for.
Gotcha. So now you hit on one of, I'll say the three food groups as far as in the non-dairy area, but you have cheese, right? We hear about like, you know, non-dairy cheese, the yogurt, obviously, which you're the guru of, and ice cream. I mean, do you feel like there's one of those three that's kind of lagging behind the others? Like my daughter has dairy issues. So she, all of a sudden, I mean, in the last 5 years, I'd say, stuff's popping in the refrigerator. And it's like, sometimes you get that cheese and you're like, ooh, this is my daughter's a cheese. That's what, you know. So is that the one that's maybe like falling behind some of the other categories? Or
Personally, I think so. I mean, I think cheese is probably the farthest behind, partially because it's a harder product to make because cheese has to be more functional. Like if I'm going to have a yogurt, it's very unlikely I'm going to cook with that yogurt. Like I'm going to take a yogurt out of the fridge and I'm going to eat it. And all that yogurt has to do is, did it stand up well in the fridge? Did it, you know, did you open it and it looked good and it's creamy
be consistent.
And tastes great? Yeah. Cheese is tough. I mean, like, you know, we've done a little bit of work in the early days on like mozzarellas and things, and they're difficult because you might be putting the mozzarella on a pizza and it goes into a 500 degree oven. And now it's going to be like, you're going to burn, you know, plant-based cheeses will tend to burn and all the oil comes out and you've got to, you know, kind of this charred residue with a big pool of oil. And then you might have that cheese cold and the cheese tastes completely different. It's like, it's kind of starchy and not great. And so what I've seen with cheeses is some cheeses perform very well when heated. They become flexible and melty and creamy. And you wouldn't want to eat those cold. So on your, you know, on your sandwich, you're going to make a, you know, a turkey and cheese sandwich. That cheese might not taste great. And then vice versa. Some are going to work well cold. And so that's been challenging because if you go in the store and you're like, okay, I'm going to go buy, you know, some cheese slices as a person who wants a non-dairy cheese slice, it's hard to market that like, hey, our cheese slices are only for cooking, for making grilled cheese.
Yeah, right.
Or,
right.
Hey, use this cheese slice on grilled cheese, but don't use it in your cold turkey sandwich. And so that's where I've seen personally issues is that one will taste great in one usage setting, but horrible in the other. But the consumer's not trained to think that way because most consumers are like, hey, if I buy a slice of cheddar cheese, I could put it in my grilled cheese or I could put it on my sandwich and it tastes great in both places. Yeah. Plant-based cheese doesn't tend to work like that. And so I think that's where plant-based cheese has tended to lag behind. And it's the same thing with cream cheese. Cream cheese suffers the same problem. Somebody might have a great plant-based cream cheese that's spreadable on a warm bagel, but you could never make a cheesecake with it. It'll just turn into a pool of oil. And so I would say cheese is the most technologically challenging and therefore has been the biggest laggard in terms of like adoption and just quality, you know, not quality, but just taste characteristics or organoleptic characteristics.
Mm-hmm. So you made a good point about, we talked to consumer, right? We're talking about the consumer's experience. So how important do you think sustainability is in the purchasing decision of plant-based consumers today?
Another great question, Michael. I mean, it's a tricky one. I, my perspective as a food guy, first and foremost, is if it doesn't taste great, nothing else matters.
That's
and when
right.
I think about how the consumer looks at a product, is like, first, it's got to taste great. Because there's mm-hmm. very few examples of products where you're like, it doesn't taste good, but people consume it. And then you're probably looking at something like nutritional profile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it, do I need dairy-free or lactose-free, or is it high in protein or low in sugar? I think sustainability is probably, it's like a, you know, and out of price, and then, you know, can I afford it? Right. That matters. Yeah. If I can't afford it, it doesn't matter either. I think sustainability is, in my vision of a plant-based consumer, many consumers today, you know, it's on the checklist. It's just farther down the checklist.
Yeah.
So sustainability is important, but if you don't get the price right, if you don't get the taste right, if you don't get the nutritionals right, again, it doesn't matter how sustainable it is if I can't afford it or if I don't like it. So I think it's on the list. It's certainly on the list for younger consumers. It's probably just checkbox number 4 or 5.
Yeah. I mean, you're nailing it. I mean, we do and market food brands across the gamut. Some are really good for you and some aren't so good for you, but it all does come down to taste. No matter all the things you can say about it, the sustainability, where it's from, nutritional things, all that stuff's great. And, you know, but we still buy based on emotion, by or the taste, and how does it, you know, and all of that. So then we'll back into it with logic, right, and rationalization. But you know, it's gotta taste great. So you know, with all your experience in dairy, plant based, again, global experience, are there global trends out there that are ahead of the U.S. when it comes to plant based dairy?
You know, it's interesting because I would say, you know, in some areas we've been ahead of the globe. I mean, so protein, like, you know, protein content, that really took hold in the U.S. with the explosion in Greek yogurt, you know, going back to like, say, 2010, 2011. Like we talked about earlier, you go into a U.S. retailer and you see protein everywhere. That trend has really caught on in Europe. So now in the last couple of years, all of a sudden Europe is like protein, 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 everything. It's like, it's funny. It's just, it's like followed the US. You know, conversely, like one of the things, I was the first guy to do dairy yogurt in a pouch. So squeezed resealable pouches that you see everywhere now. You know, my old company, we were the first people to do that. Why did we get into that? Well, two reasons. We saw what Go-Go Squeeze was doing with applesauce. They took a commodity applesauce, put it into a squeeze pouch and set the world on fire. And then I was over in Europe at my business partner's, one of their factories. And I asked the plant manager, what's the biggest thing you're making there right now? Like, what can you not keep up with? And he was like, kids yogurt pouches.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, if kids yogurt pouches are so hot in Europe, it's going to come to the US. And so we got into it. Obviously now pouches have completely exploded in the US. What I see in Europe today, which I think is a little bit ahead of the US, and I'm watching it closely, is just dairy desserts. Like the US has historically been an ice cream market. So if you want dessert, it's like, hey, I'm going to have ice cream, pie or cake, or maybe a candy bar. Europe is very much a refrigerated dessert market. They have everything in a cup. You know, you've got refrigerated cheesecakes in a cup, tiramisus in a cup, you know, really indulgent puddings and mousses and, you know, all sorts of just, you know, trifles. And so they have a lot of very sophisticated dessert concepts in spoonable, like yogurt type cups. And you see that starting to emerge more and more in the US. You're starting to see things like, you know, some of the big brands are sort of bridging the divide and going, well, we have yogurt and now we have this yogurty dessert and now we have this like non-cultured desserty thing. And I'm starting to see that more, even like, you know, I go to Wegmans, I walk Wegmans a lot. They're an important customer to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they now have a dedicated dairy dessert section that they never had. You know, that didn't exist there 2 or 3 years ago. It was just, they had sort of puddings. They kind of had yogurt and kind of continued into pudding and, you know, other little things like Petit Pot and other sort of interesting brands were thrown in there. You know, and now they finally said, hey, you know, dairy desserts are an important, or I should say refrigerated desserts are an important enough part of what's happening that we're going to have a dedicated refrigerated dessert section. And I think a lot of that's coming from Europe because in Europe, you have a lot of those, like it's a very big section in Europe. Mm-hmm. If you go walk a European grocery store and look in the refrigerated set, you're going to see a whole bunch of yogurt, a whole bunch of drinkables. Drinkables are also coming. Drinkables have been big in Europe for quite some time and they're coming here in a bigger way. But you're going to see a really big refrigerated dairy dessert set that hasn't existed in the US.
Is there a possibility for a plant-based dairy dessert set?
Yeah, I don't know about a whole set, but there's definitely, it's definitely part of the equation. You know, we're making, you know, people think our coconut yogurt's like a dessert, and you know, some of the innovation we're working on is more like desserty type flavors there, and they taste phenomenal. And I think you're going to see that where you're, it's going to be the same conversation. Like, you know, I know the Petite Pop brand, they have like, they have their dairy, you know, mousses, and they have their plant-based mousses, and they kind of play in both places. And they play right in the same set right next to each other.
That's great. So how do you balance? I mean, because you've done this now really, really twice. You've, and again, I can't underestimate the capital costs of building a plant. Right? A manufacturing facility.
It's not $1 million doesn't go very far in dairy. Somebody told me that early on in my career, and I was like, I kind of laughed, and now I kind of cry.
Yeah. It's not like you just go out in your garage and say, hey, I'm going to fire up this machine. So how do you balance between chasing a trend? And you did it in the yogurt, in the Greek yogurt side, and then you did it again in plant-based. How do you balance that, you know, with creating these products and in understanding which ones have the long-term staying power?
I mean, it's tricky. I mean, you know, you're trying, you know, for me, I'm an entrepreneurial guy, and, you know, you're trying to take calculated risks. I mean, on the one hand, you've got a manufacturing platform that you have to respect because you can't constantly every 2 years redo everything. It's just too much money. And so you're trying to use the platform you have and how can we innovate around the edges? You know, for example, you know, we're really good at putting stuff into cups. And so for me, it's like, you know, the trends I'm looking at tend to be things that are in cups. You know, in my old company, we're really good at putting things in cups, and we added a pouch filler and got really good at putting things in pouches. And so you try to make these sort of calculated, you know, you take calculated risks. You try to, you know, you try to quantify what the upside opportunity is. But everything costs a lot of money. I mean, especially in this environment where you have things like, you know, tariffs and, you know, other sort of external costs that, you know, raise prices on equipment and things like that. It's tough. I mean, it's a constant balancing act, and you're constantly just trying to evaluate, you know, what is the opportunity? What is the margin and volume opportunity versus what is the investment? And we do a lot of ROI calculations in my operation. And that's constantly what you're looking at. And, you know, sometimes you get it right and that's great. And you pop the champagne. And unfortunately, sometimes you get it wrong and you say, well, I've got this piece of equipment that I now have to go sell in the used market because I don't need it anymore. And that happens too.
Yeah, no doubt. All right. Well, look, you have a great aptitude for this entire industry. So I'm going to play a little game here called This or That.
All right.
And this is really your personal preferences. I'll name two options related to your company, and you tell me which of the two options you prefer. Here we go. R&D lab or factory floor?
Oh, great question. I R&D lab. I mean, I'm a food microbiologist. I love innovation. I get really excited about opportunity. And so I like to get in the R&D lab and try things and see
but
things.
But I know you and you're an operator too. So I know the factory floor is just right there. So you do bring that. I mean, I know that about you. You bring that great balance between two things. That's why you're so successful. So that's awesome. Plant-based cheese or plant-based yogurt?
I think I know the answer. Oh, definitely plant-based yogurt.
Yeah. Early mornings or late nights?
Early mornings.
Me too. Data or gut instinct?
You know, it's interesting. I'm a scientist by training, and I've kind of traversed between the two, but I am definitely, as I get older, going more towards data.
Yeah. Oat milk or almond milk?
Oat milk.
There you go. Cooking at home or dining out?
You know, it's a toss up. Like, I really like cooking, and I have a couple of meals that are sort of like my go-to meals that I like to make. So I like to cook at home, and I would probably lean that way. Although if somebody wants to go to a great restaurant, I'll never say no.
We've hit a few.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so what's next for Culture Fresh Foods or for you? I mean, anything entrepreneurial projects in the works, anything new, exciting that's rolling around in there?
Yeah. I mean, so for us at Culture Fresh, I mean, we're working on a bunch of opportunities. I mean, we're looking at, you know, I had mentioned earlier, like the coconut yogurt parfaits are starting to get a lot of traction. And I think what's happening is consumers are going into these traditional retailers. They're used to having like low fat yogurt, you know, parfaits that you buy ready made. And, you know, coconut parfaits just taste better and hold up better, and they're creamier and richer. And so, you know, we're doing more things like, where can we play a role in plant-based as part of something bigger? And so we're doing a more like bulk ingredient stuff. Another area, cold brew coffee. You know, we've started making, you know, bulk, because we don't have like bottle filling equipment. So we're doing like mostly spoonable and spreadable, but we can do bulk stuff. A lot of oat milk for like cold brew coffee. And again, all of those consumers for cold brew coffee, they're generally speaking, they're under the age of 25.
Yep.
And what do they want? They want oat and almond lattes.
Yep.
And so we're getting a lot more traction in sort of those. It's just those are interesting emerging areas for us where there's a lot of opportunity for growth, mm-hmm. at least what we see. I mean, the cold brew market's on fire, the canned cold brew market, and those consumers want oat milk lattes. And an oat milk latte is 30 to 40% of that can is oat milk.
Right.
And so if you can make a great oat milk that can stand up in a can, you can have some success. And again, like I said a little bit earlier, like kind of looking at like desserty flavors, like we see like coconut is really, it is the leading plant-based type of yogurt. Mm-hmm. And it's also just a great platform for like desserts. Cause think about the, like what we're seeing is like we launched a coconut banana yogurt at Wegmans, which was their category manager loves banana. And he's like, hey, you should do this. It's phenomenal. And it makes sense. It's logical. It's like, okay, it's like banana cream pie.
Right.
And so you think about flavors like banana cream pie or, you know, you think about like a daiquiri, like pineapple and coconut, like there's certain flavors that you can just really, and that's an example going back to the earlier conversation where, you know, a dairy yogurt, me personally, I would not have a dairy banana yogurt. It tastes like blah. It tastes like a kid's thing. You have a dairy coconut yogurt. It's like eye opening. It's like, holy crap. Like I need another one of those. And that's so awesome. That's an example where I think if I was in a store and I'm at a Wegmans, I might be buying, you know, Chobani, you know, mm-hmm. blueberry, strawberry, vanilla yogurt, but coconut banana, coconut mm-hmm. pineapple, you know, coconut passion fruit. Oh my God. Like they just knock it out of the park. It's just That's a totally awesome. Different experience.
That's excellent. Tom, I got one last question. You sort of slid into it a little earlier, the answer, I think, but I'll throw it out anyway. I always end with this. If you had one final meal, what would you eat and why?
Yeah, I slid into it a little bit. I mean, so I'm not a vegetarian, even though I own a plant-based company. I used to be in dairy, although I don't eat very much meat. You know, I tend to be more towards a vegetarian diet, I guess, a little bit. But I love a good chicken parmesan, like a chicken parm. Oh my gosh. Like a good chicken parm. Just that is something that's hard to beat for me. I just love it. So
that's awesome. Are you making it yourself or are you going out for it?
Either, okay. Either one. Like I like to think I make a good chicken parm. But if I'm at a great Italian restaurant, probably more likely than not, I'm going to get their chicken parm.
That's awesome. Well, Tom, it was phenomenal. I mean, you're wonderful and excellent at what you do. I always learn from you in all of our meetings, and I just congratulations on all your success.
Thanks for being
a part of the program.
Thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
All good, man. Thank you.
Thank you. Yep.